This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
I want to talk about another story today. Aaron Spencer, this is the dad in Arkansas that rescued his daughter after she was kidnapped by a man who already had, 47 counts against him for essaying his daughter. And he was released on a low bond and then decided to show up late at night, kidnap the daughter, and flee. Well, dad was like, where the hell did she go? They called 911. He gets in his truck, starts driving, comes across him, and gets him to pull off to the side of the road. Screams, let my daughter out of the vehicle. He doesn't. The perpetrator proceeds to get out of the vehicle, approach dad, Aaron Spencer, to which he's met with gunfire, which I think almost any dad would meet someone with gunfire if you steal their child and had already been charged with violating them 47 times. And you're now approaching him in the middle of the night after the daughter is kidnapped in the perpetrator's vehicle. Well, he's being charged with second degree murder because America. That's what's going on right now. But the Lono County prosecutor is not backing down. They're not saying, you know, that was a bad idea. Maybe we shouldn't charge him with second degree murder. They've now filed new motions asking the court to play body cam video from July 8th of 2024, 3 months before the actual shooting, where Aaron Spencer is furious after learning what happened to his daughter, as any sane parent would be. I'd be concerned if the parent didn't give a shit. He told deputies he didn't trust the system. I wouldn't either, and said sometimes you've got to handle things yourself, or something to that effect. The state now wants jurors to see that as proof of intent, a father already planning vigilante justice. The defense says it was raw emotion, not premeditation, and that when Spencer found the man under a no-contact order with his daughter in that truck at 1 a.m., it was about protection, not revenge. Bob Mott, a defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, with us. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about the body cam footage. This is something that is new to the conversation, and anything else that may be now coming to light from the state's perspective on this. Is this it? Is this all they got to stand on to say, see, it was premeditation, or is there anything else up their sleeve that we're not aware of in this story?
Well, we don't know for certain. So they had filed their motion, their response to the defense's motion in limine, and that particular motion in limine was filed in order to try to keep out those very statements that you were talking about with respect to the things that Aaron was saying mm-hmm. when they first came in contact with him, when they became aware of the outcry, right? Mm-hmm. So there was a mandatory reporter that was at the family's house where their daughter had met Michael Fossler, who is the victim, and I'm using air quotes for those just listening, if there are those. This guy had obviously been grooming the child and then essayed her, sounds like multiple times over a period of time. And so it's obviously a raw, open, gaping wound when Aaron and Heather end up finding out about it. And, you know, they're talking to him right after he found out. One of those folks that was in that family happened to be a mandatory reporter. That's how it ends up getting reported that you know, this is what Aaron had said, you know. Mm-hmm. So that at that point, law enforcement goes to him and, you know, and Aaron's like, what do you want me to say, man? You know, it's like it, like you guys, you're not going to do anything about it. When's he, you know, and he kind of puts it back on it. It was a long conversation between him and two cops wherein he's kind of putting them up against the wall and saying, okay, well, what would you do in this situation? Yeah. You know, one of the cops turns around and says, well, yeah, I actually, one of my children was abused. And you know, Aaron's like, okay, well, what happened to them? You know, did he get life in prison? No. Okay. So he's going to be out on the street soon. Right. So like, you know, in that moment in time, which is 3 months prior to this. So this is mm-hmm. before even that Fossler gets arrested, you know, so and this is at the point in time where they're able to talk Aaron down. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk him down. Aaron doesn't go and do anything, as much as Aaron may have wanted to go and do something at that particular time, which I think is a normal feeling for any parent.
Sure.
you know, but they're able to talk them down and they say, all right, let, you know, just let the law take care of this. Let's let it go through the system and, you know, just trust the system. And he says, fine.
But the system didn't work.
Mm-hmm. So, right. And, you know, the part of the, like, and if people are kind of just poking their heads and they don't know the story, ultimately Fossler's charged with, I think it was 43 different counts, varying from SA all the way down to, I think it was cyber stalking and then, you know, possession of whatever that acronym people always use for child pornography.
CSAM, right? Or something CSAM, like that.
Yeah, something like that. Like we just never called it that in the courtroom.
Yeah.
So it's not something that ever stuck with me. But
I had to learn the other week. I'm like, what is C? I'm like, oh, that's what that is. Yeah. Know, kept popping up in the story. I'm like, huh?
Yeah. Okay, people are always like, oh, Bob, they could tell that I'm struggling to try to remember what that acronym is. So at any rate, he ends up getting charged with it. And the very same judge that is sitting on his second degree murder case is the same judge that handled that case. She ends up giving Fossler a $50,000 bond, which means that you only have to post 10% of that in order to get out. So he only had to come up with $5,000 and he's out. And so for the next 3 months, he's out and about just living his life. And of course he begins to groom the child, the very same victim again, unbeknownst to the Spencers, to leading up to the night where they find out that she's not in her room because the dog is barking. They go in there and Heather, his wife, calls 911. He's jumping in his truck to go see if he can find his daughter. And at that point, he sees like two ships passing in the night. He sees Fossler turning off this. I think it's, you know, State Highway 31 on to State Highway 36, which I believe is the road that the Spencers live on.
Yeah.
So Aaron turns around. He's honking. He's flashing his lights, trying to get this guy to pull over. He's not pulling over. From what I've heard, he drives right by the Spencers' house and just keeps going. And this chase goes on for 6 miles until Aaron runs him off the road. And at that point, as you described, whatever happens there happens, and Aaron ends up shooting and killing him. And so, yeah, we've gotten to the point now where this thing's on the verge of trial. It's supposed to be going to trial, I believe, January 26th. So right after the new year. And, you know, right now they're fighting about what's going to get in and what's going to get out. I have a feeling that these statements are going to get in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that these statements hurt him. I think that the time lapse that's occurred, I think that 3 months, this wasn't a vigilante act. No. I get increasingly more frustrated when people try to term this as him being a vigilante, because I've done a lot of lives on this case.
Yeah.
And I get very perturbed when people start saying that it was a vigilante thing. I'm like, if it would have been a vigilante thing,
he'd be dead.
Aaron Spencer would have gone over there the day that he bonded out to take care of business. You know, that's not what occurred. Nothing occurred. And I don't care how she was taken out of the house, whether it was by her walking
that too.
Out, you know, that's the other thing, man.
That's a curious question that people ask. And I'm always like, it's a child. Yeah. It's a child you're talking about. You're talking about a 72-year-old man getting how old was she?
At the time of the first essay, she was 13. At the time
13? Yeah.
She's 14.
Getting a 13, 14-ish year old out of convincing her to leave her house in some way, shape, or form. A child. There's no equation here where this is, oh, she's making an informed decision in her best interests. That's preying on a child. It does. I don't care if he literally kidnapped her and pulled her out of the house with a bag over her head, or if she walked out on free will. It's the same damn thing.
I agree.
It doesn't matter.
So disgusting.
I could not agree more. But so when we were digging into the case the other night, and Allie kind of, she was devil's advocating during that live. And she was like, well, you know, because some of the stuff that came out that was pretty interesting in terms of like getting a bird's eye or a little bit of a sneak peek of what the state's case is going to be is that, you know, obviously they have Aaron's phone and his data mm-hmm. from his phone. And, you know, there's inconsistencies with the fact of him saying he, like, because they were asking, why didn't you call 911? He's like, oh, I didn't use my phone. I was chasing some guy at 70 miles an hour that had my daughter in the truck. And they're like, oh, well, you know, here we looked at his phone records and he made a phone call, you know, at some point during a minute and 16 minute phone call or 16 second phone call during the chase. So, you know, he wasn't being truthful. He did, in fact, use his phone. And then before he ends up calling 911, he texts his wife twice, or called his wife, or called somebody at the house, or called somebody at on his wife's phone, presumably his wife, which is exactly what I'd be doing. Right. You know, like after the thing's done, before I call 911.
Didn't she already call 911? Weren't they already aware of this?
On the phone with 911. Yep.
So why would he call again?
Exactly.
He's stuck in the moment. He's dealing with what he's dealing with right then and there. He's not going to be like, maybe I should call the police. No, he is after his freaking daughter.
Right. 100%. It's so easy for people to sit on their couches with their phone in their hand, listening to cases like this, or, you know, sitting on their computer and watching us on the big screen while they're sitting in their couch and sipping a Starbucks and saying, oh, well, that's not what I would do. You have no idea what you would do unless you are in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
I reject anybody telling me what the proper response is in that situation unless they have lived it. If you've lived it, I'm listening. How did you respond? Okay, well, you're not Aaron Spencer. We all have a different trauma response.
The whole thing, he's taking the law into his own hands. No, he's taking his daughter's life into his own hands because the law has already failed on that part. The law has already dropped the ball. Moment.
Yeah, no. She was in trouble right then and there. He is watching it. His body is responding to his child about to be whatevered.
Exactly. You know,
so he is responding in that moment. It's not like, well, I'm going to go get that guy after the fact. No, he is watching it happen live.
100%. And you know, so I got into this discussion the other night wherein when we pull up the statute and we're looking at the statute and what they're going to employ is a self-defense, but really defense of others' defense, okay? And in that thing, the first kind of hurdle that you have to get over in terms of employing that defense successfully is that Aaron cannot have been the initial aggressor, which clearly no one has been able to put forth any kind of argument whatsoever that Aaron was the initial aggressor. You cannot make the argument that him forcing him off the road makes him the initial aggressor, because that's not right.
He stole his kid from his house. That's the aggressive move.
Exactly. At the point in time that he sees him drive by with his daughter in the vehicle, to me, that's when the clock starts. People keep wanting to talk about the fact of, okay, well, and I'm talking about the clock in terms of determining whether or not Aaron Spencer was reasonable in his actions. And they're going back to, in the state, in terms of what they filed, is again giving us a sneak peek of what they're going to try and employ at trial. And the thing that they're going to say is that Aaron had reason to know, okay, that she hadn't been kidnapped, that she left on her own on her own accord. Tony, I know where you're going to go. She was 14. Mm-hmm. She was a child. I'm 100% with you. This is the argument that they're going to be trying to put forth. Now, there is a problem with that in the state of Arkansas, wherein at the age of 14, in that state, kidnapping does not apply.
What?
it's crazy. It's crazy. Like Allison pulled it up in terms of like you can actually if they're at the age of 14, they can consent to like leaving, where it's not considered kidnapping, even if she goes out of the house on her own accord. But none of that matters because what they're arguing is that he had reason to know because she had used a stuffed animal, at least in theory, to make it seem as if she was still in bed. But none of that matters to me where this thing starts, because Aaron doesn't know if that's just her sneaking out of the house. He doesn't necessarily. I mean, would he probably immediately think, oh, this guy got her again? Maybe.
possibly.
If you're a responsible parent, it doesn't even fucking matter if she's gone. Right. If she snuck out of the house, you're still going and looking for her. You're not like, oh, she put the stuffed animal there. She just snuck out in the middle of the night. Let's go watch a rerun of SNL. No.
Exactly my point. Because
you're going to go find your daughter because it could be she snuck out. That's not okay. Or it could be that the creepy perv convinced her to come out too. It's one or the two. And neither are okay.
Neither, and so in my estimation, because of exactly what you said, where this thing starts in terms of kind of looking at the analysis of whether or not the defense of others is going to work, is it starts exactly when he lays eyes on the fact that his child is once again in that guy's truck.
Yeah.
That is when the clock starts for Aaron Spencer, because that is when he realizes what is going on. It doesn't matter legally how she got out of the house. The state's going to try to make it matter, but the defense is going to be able to argue, no. She just could have snuck. I don't know, man.
Why do they just keep digging into this? Are they prepared for the courthouse to burn to the ground if this guy gets off? Because I think the villagers are going to be there with flames.
But here's the thing, you guys, and I don't want to like drill down like our entire conversation wasn't worthy, because it absolutely is. But at the end of the day, the jurors are community members, their parents, their siblings. Are they going to sit there and let this monster loose? They're going to sit there and say, what if this happened to my child? What if this happened to my sister? What if this happened to me?
Are they? Because one state over, they just said to Jesse in Oklahoma, you know what? We don't care about those two 16-year-old girls that USA'd and nearly killed. Second chance, you're a good baseball player. So keep in mind the mindset of some folks in these parts.
I guess I want to believe that people are different than that.
There's plenty that are. But when you get a group, you know, together, you get a few in there that think very differently, very questionably differently than the rest, that you go, if there was only a true record of everything you've done in your life, I don't think you'd be a free human being. And they tend to think like this.
Yeah. It's, I mean, to me, this is kind of the inverse of what it normally is, where it's oftentimes that I've felt that it's going to be very tough for the defense to be able to impanel 12 people that are going to be behind our client. Right. This is a situation where I think it's going to be very, very difficult for the state to get 12 people in that box that are going to be able to look at the situation any differently than what it actually was, which is what they're asking people to do in this case. They're asking people to just disregard everything that preceded it and look at this thing in a vacuum in terms of what happened in that moment in time. And, you know, the defense has a lot of bullets to shoot in terms of that particular aspect of the case, because they're going to be able to lay out the story. Now, they're not going to be if you know, and we've heard Fossler, it's alleged this isn't the first time he's done it. The dude was 67 years old, man. Like you just don't start essaying children and abusing kids at 67. This, I'm sure, you know, when we start getting more and more information about this guy, this was not something that had just cropped up. This is going to be a thing where you're going to find that he was doing it to other people in the past, and that was
guaranteed
the person that he was. However, none of that's relevant to this case because Aaron didn't know it. Where the clock starts for Aaron is the minute that he finds out that this guy was abusing his daughter. That's like his knowledge base, because you like the whole question is. Was Aaron Spencer reasonable in his belief that he believed that Foster was going to either commit a felony against his child or harm his child? And I think that the state is going to be hard pressed to convince anybody in that set of circumstances that that's not exactly what was going on there. Either he was going to commit another essay, or he was going to commit an essay and then kill her, or he was just going to kill her because, frankly, she was the only evidence that they had against him in his 43 counts. in terms of anything beyond the stuff that they found on the devices. In terms of the essays, she's the witness because mm-hmm. all of those crimes he was charged with are related to her.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, so it's like,
I better hope there's no closeted predators on that jury that are going to find some sort of commiseration here with this guy. Because I think that's the way you get a hung jury or that's the way it's probably where you get a hung jury, on something like this. But they're out there. Look, they are out there. I did this case. I talked about it, on Morning Radio Live in Northeast Wisconsin about a week or two ago. And we took some live calls and such, and you'd be surprised. I mean, I was getting some callers saying that they were on the guy's side It's like, and I was taken aback. I was like, how is anyone seeing it that way? What sort of twisted prism is working in someone's mind where they're going, huh, I think the dad might be at fault here.
Did you push back? Did you try to say?
Oh, yeah. My pushback was like, I really question how anyone could see that, because I go back to my tried and true phrase of only predators protect predators. I don't see any other way why someone would see this in a different way, unless you just fully did not grasp all of the details of this case, which may be people are very selective in what they pick up on.
Guessing it's that. It has
I'm hoping.
To be that,
I'm
right?
hoping. I am hoping.
Maybe they just they popped in late. They heard that this guy,
I'm hoping. I'm hoping, but you never know.
You never know what a jury is going to do. That is the only certainty in the law, is that you just never know what a jury is going to do. And it's why it's a terrifying proposition. You know, that is why people will plead out on cases where, not necessarily for a homicide, but, you know, cases wherein, you know, you could do 6 to 10 years on a serious felony and you didn't do it. But, you know, the state's offering you, we'll give you a year, and your lawyer's telling you, well, look, man, I know you're telling me you didn't do it, and I believe you. However, this evidence that they have, they might be able to convince a jury that you did do it, mm-hmm. and you're looking at a hell of a lot more time than you'd be getting if you took this plea. I mean, it happens every day in every courthouse in this country where people plead to things that they didn't do, because either the state, especially if they're not offering any jail time. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, yeah.
Never know. There's no slam dunks, though this one sure as hell feels like one. Yeah. But at this point, anything is possible.
Yeah, and you know who it definitely doesn't feel like a slam dunk to, T, is the Spencer family.
Yeah, without a doubt.
They're going through it, man. It's brutal.
It is. Bob Mata, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Check it out wherever you get podcasts. Check out the YouTube channel Defense Diaries. Just search it on YouTube and you will find it. And Buried, yes. What episode are you up to as of right now? 11?
Episode 12 dropped.
12.
Today.
12. Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay.
Yes. Buried inside the John Wayne Gacy investigation. That's it.
Yes. Check it out especially if you've been watching the Peacock.
Devil in
Disguise. Yes. We had them on the show. Have you had them on your show yet?
Sure. No, I'm working it out. It sounds like Churn's coming on the next couple of weeks, so I'm excited.
Cool.
About that.
Nice. Yeah. That'll be a good conversation. You can also go back in our archive and find that conversation. Michael Churnis is with us and discussing that case as well. But do check out Buried Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation wherever you get podcasts. Until next time, for Stacey, Todd, and Bob, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.